Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
On March 29, 1943, a fishing boat named the Bratholm sailed its way through icy waters toward land along the Arctic coast of Norway. Even though it was almost April, there was still no sign of winter letting up. Not this far north, not this time of year. That part of the world would remain frozen for many weeks to come. There were 12 men aboard the Bratholm that chilly March day, and this was dangerous work they were doing. It was the third year of the war in Europe, and Nazi Germany controlled this part of the Arctic. 8 of the 12 men on board the Bratholm were the fishing boat's crew, experienced sailors who had been navigating these icy waters for years. The other 4 men were saboteurs, trained soldiers whose job was to covertly attack the German war machine and disrupt their activities in the region. On this occasion, the saboteurs had 2 primary objectives. They were to insinuate themselves into the local community and spend the summer training other members of the resistance to become saboteurs as well. This would all lead up to their primary mission, which was to occur the upcoming autumn, destroying a strategic German military airfield called Bardufoss. Although the Bratholm was ostensibly a fishing vessel, it had been retrofitted to be a warship. There were 7 heavy machine guns mounted on the deck that were kept hidden and were only meant to be deployed in the most extreme circumstances. Down in the ship's hold, the boat carried 8 tons of explosives and other light weaponry, as well as a supply of food, Arctic gear, and 3 radio transmitters. Because the work they were doing was top secret, the men knew they could never allow the boat and all its code manuals and other secret information to fall into Nazi hands. So they were prepared for any eventuality by equipping the vessel with explosive charges attached to 3 fuses that would be lit depending on how quickly trouble approached. There was a 5-minute fuse, giving the men just enough time to escape, a 30-second fuse giving them even less time, and most telling of all, 1 fuse that would blow up the entire boat almost instantaneously. That 1,000-mile stretch of North Atlantic coastline was considered highly important to the Allied war effort. It was through a narrow strip of open sea between Norway and the frozen Arctic that Allied convoys delivered supplies to the Russian Arctic ports of Archangel and Murmansk. But after seizing Norway, the Germans maintained a stranglehold on the region, making it highly difficult for the Allies to get through. Part of the problem was the geography. There were numerous islands and fjords scattered around the northern coastline, many of which had been fortified to become practically impregnable German strongholds. Because there was no chance of getting sufficient numbers of troops on the ground to wage an all-out assault on the Nazis, the Allies instead trained and deployed small groups of saboteurs to stage small, clandestine operations meant to throw a monkey wrench into German war efforts in the region. The saboteurs thought a Norwegian fishing vessel would allow them sufficient cover to bluff their way through the German warships and other defenses along the coast. If they managed to make it that far, the men planned on heading inland to Tromsø and living among the locals for months. It was risky. If they were exposed or, heaven forbid, caught, there would be no help coming to them from England. The leader of this small group of saboteurs was a man named Sigurd Eskeland. Although he was born in Norway, Eskeland had emigrated to Argentina as a young man, only returning after hearing his homeland had been overrun by fascists. The radio operator was a former merchant navy man named Salveson. The other 2 men were close friends, both of whom had trained together to become experts in small arms and explosives. One of the men was a baker's son named Per Blindheim. The other was a man named Jan Balsrud, and it's him that this story is truly about. Balsrud was the son of a maker of technical instruments in Oslo. He had just begun his own career in the family business when the Nazis invaded. He fought in the army until it became apparent that all hope was lost. After that, he managed to escape to Sweden, but Balsrid was young and patriotic, and he thirsted for adventure. So he became a courier between Sweden and Norway. He had actually been arrested once during one of these courier missions. Luckily, it had been by the Swedes, not the Nazis, or else his sentence would not have been so light. He was sentenced to 5 months' imprisonment, but only served 3 of those months before being released and ordered to leave the country. From there, he made his way to Russia, and on from there to Odessa. That's where he met Per Blindheim. The two men became fast friends. They traveled together to England through a series of exotic locales, including Bulgaria, Egypt, Bombay, South Africa, America, and Newfoundland. It was in England the two men were recruited by the British Special Operations Group known as the Ling Company, where they were trained in the art of sabotage. The two men learned much of what they needed to know to survive from the Ling Company, things like how to parachute out of an airplane, how to live off the land, how to use a sniper rifle, and how to prepare heavy explosives. Even still, there was only so much planning they could do before a mission. Orders were given to them in only the most general terms. Go here and blow up an airfield. The rest they made up as they went along. There was seldom any way to foresee what might happen along the way. That's why they didn't know that this would be their last mission together, and that they would be betrayed to the Nazis. Nor did they foresee having to destroy their boat and flee for their lives. Of the 12 men aboard the Bratholm, only Jan Balsrud would escape. His story remains one of the most harrowing and death-defying legends of World War II. I'm Nate Hale, and I have a secret escape tunnel hidden behind a poster of Rita Hayworth in my podcasting chamber. And this is The Conspirators. None of the members of the group of saboteurs were very familiar with the area this far north. Sigurd Eskeland had been provided a list of a few names of people he was told he could trust, but for the most part, the people living throughout this region were a great unknown. It was impossible to know for certain who was or who was not a Nazi sympathizer. Their plans centered around establishing themselves in the town of Tromsø, where they would use the town as a staging area to train other saboteurs to aid them in attacking the Nazi airfield in the months to come. They'd originally intended on landing on an island called Senja, about 40 miles southwest of Tromsø. But as they neared the island, they spotted an armed patrol boat in an area where no German ships were expected. They abruptly diverted course and headed to Ribenesøy, about 30 miles north of Tromsø. They dropped anchor in an isolated bay and made their way to shore. From there, they made their way inland and discovered a little cottage with smoke rising from the chimney. Inside was a middle-aged woman and her 2 children. Her husband was a fisherman who was away at sea and not expected back for weeks. She told the crew of the Bratholm she had never seen a German in the area, and she welcomed the men by cooking for them and allowing them to warm themselves by the fire. There, the men discussed what they would do next. Eskeland had once been a postal inspector, and he recalled the name of a merchant in town who had also appeared on a list of names given to them by their superiors as someone who could be trusted and might provide them with temporary shelter. So Eskeland took a couple of the ship's crew with him under cover of darkness and sailed in the Bratholm's dinghy to Ribenesøy. They found the shop and were pleased to see a light on inside. They passed a few local fishermen. They greeted them and told them they too were on a fishing trip. No one appeared suspicious of their story. Nonetheless, the men knew they needed to always remain on their guard. The Germans sometimes sent members of the Nazi army in civilian clothes to live among the locals in little towns just like this one, in order to spy on any suspicious activities. They made their way to the shopkeeper's establishment only to find the man had already gone to bed. The shopkeeper was startled and clearly terrified to see them on his doorstep. There was a notice posted next to the door that stated, "Contact with the enemy is punished by death." There were many other such notices posted elsewhere throughout town. After inviting themselves inside, Eskeland and the other men quickly realized they had made a mistake. This wasn't the man Eskeland had expected. The shopkeeper informed them that the man who used to own the shop had died months earlier. He was a new owner who had kept the name of the business intact. The shopkeeper had a lot to be worried about. The man had a family of his own, and just by letting them in the door, he had put all of them in danger. He told Escalin that he couldn't help them. Escalin apologized for his intrusion and warned the shopkeeper not to say anything to anyone about their visit before leaving. We don't know exactly what happened after Escalin left the shopkeeper alone, but by some accounts, it appears he told his wife and brother about the strange visit. The shopkeeper was terrified because being disloyal to the Germans meant an almost certain trip to the concentration camps for not only himself, but for his wife and his children as well. Before they left, the shopkeeper did give Escalin the names of two fishermen who might help them. Escalin went away from the shop worried that the man might give them up to the Nazis. But short of killing the man, there was nothing he could do about it. The shopkeeper's information did turn out to be accurate. Those two fishermen were willing to help them hide their fishing boat in some caves near Toftfjord. Escalin returned to the Brat home where he informed the others what had happened. They discussed it among themselves and they all decided there was nothing they could do about it. If trouble came, they would deal with it, like always. The men went to bed aboard the boat, listening to the occasional chatter of machine gun fire in the distance, a near constant sound of the war going on all around them. It was almost noon the following day and Escalin was sleeping below deck when he heard men shouting from up top that the Germans were approaching. Everyone rushed to the deck only to see a German warship sailing directly toward them through the fjord. Escalin immediately began shouting orders to abandon ship. In the distance, they could see German troops piling into two smaller boats being lowered into the water. Falsridden Salveson began dumping gasoline on the code books and set them on fire. Escalin and Blindheim climbed down into the hatch and lit the five-minute fuse that would destroy the boat. As soon as the small German boats were in the water, the larger warship began firing its machine guns and a 3-pound cannon. The shots weren't necessarily meant to kill, just to prevent them from fleeing. The Germans meant to capture them alive. Escalin ordered Jan Balsrud to hold them off. Jan grabbed a submachine gun and returned fire, emptying his clip at the Germans' bridge. After that, the saboteurs climbed into the Bratholm's dinghy and prepared to take off. They needed to wait it out as long as possible to make sure the charges detonated. Some of the ship's crew had already made their way to shore on another dinghy, but the machine gun fire had torn through a few of the sailors, and Balsrud could see their bodies floating in the water. A German landing party had already reached shore and began apprehending the survivors. Balsrud and the others aboard the dinghy began to row for shore. By now, the German warship had pulled up alongside the Bratholm. Machine gun fire punched holes in the dinghy and it began to sink. As soon as the German ship scraped up against the Bratholm, the explosion they had been waiting for finally occurred. Only, it was much smaller than they expected. Only the primer had blown, which had just enough force to blow the hatch covers off. But the ship did not immediately explode with it. The German ship fired the 3-pound cannon at the dinghy and missed. By now, the Bratholm was completely ablaze. When the flames finally reached the cargo, the explosion the saboteurs had been waiting for at long last occurred. The Bratholm exploded in a massive fireball. Streaks of debris covered in burning fuel flew through the sky. Escalin was blown overboard by the shockwave. Jan threw himself half into the water, trying to drag the man back into the dinghy. Then another shot came from the 3-pound cannon that shattered the dinghy into pieces. All the men were now bobbing in the frigid water. They were 70 yards from shore. The men swam frantically for land as machine gun fire rained down all around them. Jan Balsrud managed to stumble his way into the shallows with his friend Per Blindheim a few steps behind him. Balsrud barely had time to turn and see as a bullet caught Blindheim in the skull, driving him face first into the water. Jan ran blindly, clambering up over a rocky bank before finding cover behind a large rock. From his vantage point, he could see that Escalin was lying on the beach, but he couldn't tell if the man was alive or dead. Salveson had collapsed as well. He was clearly alive, but unable to go any farther from sheer exhaustion. A bullet ricocheted off the rock just over Balsrud's head. He was under fire from both sides, and he knew he couldn't stay where he was. He could see four Germans along the shore marching closer to his position. Another German patrol came at him from the other side as they climbed over a low hill. Balsrud realized there would be a brief moment when they reached the dip at the foot of the mound where the patrol couldn't see him, so he took that opportunity to make a run for it. When Balsrud went into the water, he'd had on two rubber sea boots, but somehow in all the chaos, he had lost one of those boots, and one of his feet was completely bare. He couldn't think about that at the moment, though. He ran for the nearest hill. A German officer shouted at him to halt, but Balsrud kept running. The German officer fired at him with a pistol and missed. Balsrud had an automatic pistol on him. He could see the officer that had fired at him had on a Gestapo uniform. He realized the four Germans approaching him would be within his line of fire once they reached a spot in the snow about 6 yards below him. The Gestapo officer was the first to appear at the base of the hill. Balsrud squeezed the trigger, but the gun didn't go off. It was jammed with ice and would not fire. He tried two more times, only nothing happened. Now the men were only a few paces away from him. He ejected a cartridge, which broke the ice inside the pistol, and finally he was able to shoot. He shot the Gestapo officer twice and killed him immediately. His body rolled down the slope toward the feet of his men. Jan shot another soldier after that, and he went down as well. The other two soldiers turned and fled, sliding down the hill to avoid getting shot in the back. Balsrud clambered to his feet and began making a long, difficult climb up the gully. For a few moments, it was eerily silent. It took all his strength to climb up. He finally reached a wide, snow-covered slope, and as soon as he popped his head up, he could see the German warship in the water close by. More importantly, he realized anyone on board could see him. He was wide open, a dark shape on a big white expanse, a perfect target for anyone who decided to take a shot at him. He clawed his way up the slope. Machine gun fire burst through the pristine snow all around him. The 3-pound cannon went off, making an explosion of white terrifyingly close to his current position. There was nowhere to hide. All he could do was climb on and pray the Germans would continue to miss. Finally, he reached the top of the hill where he could at least take some shelter behind it. He had a clear vantage point where he could see some German soldiers near the beach rounding up the survivors. He still wasn't sure if his other fellow saboteurs were alive or dead. Some of the German soldiers were staring directly at him and headed his way. Balsrud began to run even before he realized his bare foot was throbbing in pain and he was leaving a trail of blood in the snow. He realized at some point he had been shot, the bullet ripping a huge chunk off his big toe. It wasn't bleeding a lot, though, because his foot was mostly frozen. At some point, most men would have realized what a hopeless situation they were in and just given up. Jan Balsrud was wounded, barefoot, in unfamiliar territory, on a tiny island in waist-deep snow with the German army all around him. But Jan Balsrud wasn't most people. He had been trained to live off the land and to survive at all costs. So that's what he intended to do. He knew his next major goal would be to get off this island and make his way to the mainland. This was a daunting task, though, because the island he was on was separated from the mainland by two sounds, each of which were several miles wide and patrolled by German boats. He trudged through the heavy snow toward the southern slopes where the snow wasn't so deep. Along the way, he continued to double back and obscure his tracks as best he could. He found shelter where he could as well, but there were many long stretches where he was completely out in the open and an easy target for a sniper shot. He finally made his way to some rocks, which he climbed and hopped his way over. This, at least, would make it more difficult for the Germans to follow his tracks. He had a vague idea of making his way toward water where, if he was lucky, he might find a boat he could steal. He was freezing. He'd been completely submerged in sub-zero water, and his underclothes were still soaked. At one point, he spotted two little hay sheds. He would have loved nothing more than to climb inside one for shelter and sleep for a bit. But he knew that would be suicide since the sheds were so obvious a hiding place the Germans would surely find him. He decided his safest bet was to make his way to the beach and wade back out into the water. He swam for a tiny islet about 50 yards away. There he was able to hide among the rocks out of sight from the German patrols he could see marching nearby still looking for him. This also gave Balsrud a little time to examine the bloody mess of his foot. He packed the wound with some peat moss he scraped off the rocks, then covered the wounded foot with his remaining sock. That way he had a boot on one foot and a sock on the other. It was the best he could do at the moment. From his position, Balsrud was able to watch the soldiers positioned along the beach looking for him. It became clear these men were poorly trained, which was in keeping with Balsrud's intelligence he'd been given about the region. Many of the soldiers stationed around this area were low-grade troops with poor morale from months of isolation in the frigid environment with nothing much to do. It wasn't much of an advantage, but it would have to do. Balsrud watched and waited as the patrols kept marching right by him on his tiny island perch. No one noticed him. By the time night fell, the men were still searching for him and were now using torches to see. Every now and then, Balsrud heard a shot fired, which indicated the men were spooked and firing at shadows. This also gave Balsred another realization. These soldiers were afraid of him. This gave Balsred another tiny boost of confidence. He knew he couldn't remain where he was much longer. If he did, the Germans would surely find him, or he would freeze to death. He had no choice but to try to swim for another island. He considered all his options and realized his best chance would be to swim for the farthest and most difficult island to reach, Vargasund. He could barely see the land mass from where he was. Later, he would barely remember making up his mind and diving into the water once again. His body ached and his muscles cramped terribly as he swam for the distant shore. He eventually managed to drag himself up onto the beach where he collapsed. After a little while, he began to hear voices. Footsteps approached him on the beach. He tensed up and waited for what was to come. But these weren't German soldiers, but two little girls. They were chattering to each other in Norwegian and abruptly stopped when they saw him. He didn't want to frighten them. He sat up slowly and greeted them in the friendliest voice he could muster. Then he asked them for help, and if they could possibly take him to their parents. The little girls' names were Donna and Olag, and although they appeared wary, they agreed to take Balsred back to see their mommy. They led Balsred to a tiny house where two grown women were inside, along with several other children. The two women were horrified at the sight of the frozen, limping wild man the children brought home. They only settled down a little once Balsred began to tell them his story.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
The women allowed him in and gave him some food and dry clothes and let him warm himself by the fire. Balsred thanked them profusely. He warned them that if German soldiers came around asking for him, they would need to protect themselves by saying he had forced them to help him at gunpoint. One of the women actually lived on Toftfjord and had seen and heard some of the gunfight that had taken place on the beach. It was actually the gunfire that had caused her and her children to row across the fjord to take refuge with her friend here. The women helped dress Balsred's wounded foot and gave him a spare rubber boot one of their husbands had left behind. Balsred wanted to stay longer, but he knew every minute he remained there, he put the women and children in more danger. Besides, he needed to get off these islands and make his way to the mainland. The islands along the coast were too small and with too few opportunities to remain hidden for long. If Balsred could make it to the mainland, his plan was to make his way across the country towards Sweden. One of the older boys Balsred met agreed to row him to yet another nearby island called Ringvasoy. It was there the boy said he could find a man named Jensen, who had a motorboat that would take him to the mainland. The boy offered to personally lead him to Jensen's house, but Balsred told him no. He had already put him and his family in too much danger. Balsred made his way to Jensen's house, only to be told by the man's wife that Jensen had already left for the mainland in the motorboat the day before. She was a midwife. She was warm and welcoming to him after hearing his story. This was something that was repeated multiple times during Balsred's long trek across Norway. To this day, there are still people throughout Norway who will gladly tell you all about Jan Balsred's long journey and the places he stopped along the way. Strangers were often shocked to see him at first and naturally suspicious. That is, until they saw his wounded toe and took it as evidence he wasn't some secret Nazi agent looking to test their loyalty. It seemed highly unlikely a Nazi would shoot himself in the foot just to trick the locals. He was told of a man named Einar Sorensen who lived on the southern end of the island and ran the local telephone exchange. Sorensen, the family said, would help him across to the mainland. Sorensen had lost a son in the war and was sympathetic to the Allies. Balsred decided he would walk the 30 miles directly across the island to its southern tip in order to find Sorensen. This proved to be easier said than done. The terrain was hilly and snow-covered, and the rubber boots he wore were terrible for hiking. They slipped on the ice constantly or got stuck in this deep snow. It took Balsred several days to cross from one side of the island to the other, but once he did, Sorensen proved to be every bit as helpful as he'd heard. Balsred learned from Sorensen that some of the men he'd been sailing with had actually survived and been arrested. This likely meant the Nazis now knew everything about him and his plans. Sorensen rode Balsrud to the mainland and wished him well in his journey. By that point, Balsrud realized how truly alone he was. He had no special information or significance to the war effort. He really had only himself and the occasional kindness of strangers to rely on. Jan Balsrud spent 9 weeks traveling across Norway, often out in the open, with no shelter. Sometimes he would knock on people's doors and ask for help, never knowing if the people inside would turn him in. But by and large, the people of Norway were far more sympathetic to his plight than he could ever have hoped for, and proved invaluable to his journey. Once a man warded off a neighbor he knew to be on the German payroll while Balsrud was hiding inside his home. A friendly fisherman along Balsrud's journey outfitted him with new boots and even a set of skis. Balsrud was an experienced skier, so when he got his skis, he thought he had it made. He even boldly zipped past a group of German soldiers on their way to breakfast. But then he skied directly into a blizzard, and things went from bad to worse. His eyes froze shut. He became so disoriented and had so much trouble breathing, he lost all ability to tell where he was. Unable to see anything, Balsrud came up with a technique to help ensure, at the very least, he wouldn't ski directly off a cliff. He would throw a snowball a short distance. If he didn't hear it land, he knew to steer in a different direction. Balsrud didn't realize it at the time, but he was actually climbing a 3,000-foot mountain called Jagavar. He might have been okay even then. That is, if he didn't get hit by an avalanche. He never saw it coming. First came a sound like thunder, then he got swept away in a wall of white snow that came hurtling down at him like a freight train. The avalanche swept him 300 feet away down into a valley, destroying his skis and causing him to lose his few belongings. When he came to, he was snowblind. He kept wandering, but by the third day, Balsrud was delirious and he could swear he could hear the voices of his friends from the Bratholm calling to him. On the fourth day, he caught a small stroke of luck when he stumbled his way toward a small house in a village called Fyroflaten. The house belonged to a man named Marius Grønvall, and he was an active member of the resistance. The Grønvalls hid Balsrud in their barn for several days and helped nurse him back to health. At one point, a German patrol stopped by and searched the barn, but didn't see Balsrud hiding in the loft above their heads. Even though the Grønvalls were able to bring Balsrud back to consciousness, by this point his health had greatly deteriorated. Frostbite had set in his injured foot, and he could no longer walk. Marius Grønvall got three of his friends to carry Balsrud on a stretcher and sneak him past the Germans through a rowboat. The men then rowed him across a fjord, but they soon realized the terrain on the other side was too steep to get across by carrying the man on a stretcher. The men hid Balsrud in a small shed while they returned to their village and came up with a new plan. They convinced a schoolteacher with carpentry skills to build a custom sled they could use to drag the injured man to safety. The sled was made in pieces that could easily be assembled and disassembled along the way. The shed where Marius Grønvall and his friends had left Balsrud has become famous and was given a rather grim nickname. Before Grønvall left him there, Balsrud joked to him that the shed was every bit as nice as the nicest hotel in London, the Hotel Savoy. The shed has become enshrined as a grim tourist destination in Norway. The original Hotel Savoy was burned down by some kids years ago, so the locals rebuilt it, and the new one still stands there to this day. Grønvall meant to return to Balsrud sooner than he did, but a storm delayed him another 5 days. It was during this time that Balsrud was left to fend for himself and make some difficult decisions. The frostbite was terrible on his wounded foot. It had been exposed to the elements far too long, and now parts of it had turned black. Balsrud was forced to use his knife to perform surgery on himself. He cut into several toes, hoping to bleed out some of the infection that he feared would soon creep up his legs. He swigged some liquor the men had left him and poured a little bit in his foot and knife to sterilize them. Then he used the knife to amputate his big toe. When Grønvall and his friends finally did return, Balsrud was in even worse shape. They strapped him to the sled and dragged him to another hiding spot 2,700 feet higher than the Hotel Savoy. But they were forced to leave him again, this time in a cave for 9 more days that became buried in snow. Another group of helpers finally found Balsrud, only they couldn't take him directly to Sweden either. They carried him a bit further but eventually were forced to leave him as well. Balsrud was forced to remain out in the open air for 5 more days. Some versions of events say the man put a gun to his head out of despair and pulled the trigger, only the gun didn't go off because it was frozen. In other tellings, Balsrud merely told the men to leave him there to die. But he didn't die. Another group of helpers eventually found him and took him to a cave further south, where he spent the next 17 days. During that time, Balstrid completing the amputation of the rest of his toes. Meanwhile, a local farmer named Nils Nilsson skilled 40 miles away to Sweden, then another 40 on the way back to find more help for Balstrid. Eventually, a group of indigenous people known as the Sami would find Balstrid and take him the rest of the way across the border. They raced him on a sled drawn by reindeer across a corner of Nazi-occupied Finland, with the Germans hot on their trail. Jan Balstrid would spend 6 months recuperating in a Swedish hospital, where he slowly learned to overcome the loss of his toes. His eyesight came back, and he began to put on weight. From there, he went to Scotland, where he learned to walk again, and he rejoined the war effort, training Allied soldiers in marksmanship. At the end of the war, Balstrid returned to Norway to witness its liberation, after which he returned to his old life, where he told and retold his story reluctantly to journalists over the years. The story of Jan Balstrid's remarkable escape has become a folk legend in Norway. It's been written about in multiple books and even been made into a movie. As an elderly man, Balstrid fell in his home and fractured his hip. X-rays revealed a cancerous tumor that had already metastasized. He died on December 30, 1988 in Oslo University Hospital. His final wish was to be buried in the fjords, in the village of Mandal along the grave of Åsmund Fosvall, one of the Norwegian resistance leaders who helped him along his journey. The Conspirators is written and produced by me, Nate Hale, an entirely fictional identity. Thanks so much for listening. There are so many remarkable details of Jan Balstrid's escape I had to skim over that I highly recommend two books. We Die Alone by David Haworth was considered for many years to be the definitive story of Jan Balstrid. More recently, another book named Defiant Courage, written by Dr. Tor Haug and Astrid Carlson Scott, was published in order to clarify some of the details they say Haworth got wrong. They're both terrific books, and I highly recommend them. In other business, I have some new Patreon supporters to thank. Thank you to Amy, Lauren, Tim, Diane, and Ryan. You're all awesome. Just a reminder that patrons of the show get access to all sorts of nifty bonuses, including stickers, magnets, t-shirts, and our exclusive bonus mini-episodes, the latest of which I just published recently. We also have a merchandise store where you can find all sorts of cool designs for conspirators' mugs, phone cases, shirts, and much, much more. I'll put a link in the show notes for both the store and my Patreon if you're interested. Beyond all that, another great way you can help support the show is to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts. Apple has a bunch of podcasting categories, and each time you rate and review us, it helps boost us in Apple's charts, and therefore spreads our names to even more people. If you're not on Apple, not to worry, you can also find us on Stitcher, Spotify, and pretty much everywhere else you get your podcasts. We also have a website, theconspiratorspodcast.com, where you can listen to our entire back catalog of shows. Elsewhere, we're on social media. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And feel free to drop us a line at theconspiratorspodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next time.